I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
These iconic words spoken by an unhinged anchorman named Howard Beale, the mad prophet of the airwaves, took America by storm in 1976 when the movie Network opened and went on to achieve cult classic status. In his new book, Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies, David Itzkoff, a culture reporter for the New York Times, recounts the surprising and dramatic story of how Network made it to the screen and how Academy Award-winning screenwriter Paddy Chayefsky prophetically envisioned the seduction of our society by mass media. Again, the name of the book is Mad as Hell. It's published by Times Books, and it's a pleasure to welcome Dave Itzkoff to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Where did your love and interest of this movie begin? How did it begin?
My best guess, as far as I can remember, because I was actually born in the year that Network came out in 1976, I probably first encountered it as a parody in Mad Magazine, which was called Nutwork. And I knew nothing of the film, didn't know who the actors were, but the sort of running joke in the Mad parody is how dirty the language in the film is. So I'm sure as a child that made me deeply fascinated with this dirty, vulgar movie. I then encountered it much later, of course, as an adult, and realized that there was much more of a story to it than just, you know, grown-ups cursing.
For you, in taking on this project and looking at the backstory of the book, what are some of the questions that you initially wanted to answer?
Well, you know, one thing that I encountered, and this goes back to 2011 when I first wrote about the film in the New York Times and was given access to Paddy Chayefsky's papers, which are owned by the New York Public Library, there's always been this sort of enduring myth about the film that Chayefsky wrote it as some kind of act of revenge, that he was deliberately satirizing certain people in the TV industry who had wronged him somehow. And even going back to that original Times article, it was pretty clear that that was not true, that what you learn when you look at his screenplay drafts and the years that he spent poring over the project, that this was something that had evolved in a much more organic way, and in fact it was almost a kind of summation of his life's work up to that point, that even if you go, you know, all the way back to his earliest teleplays and classics like Marty, which of course became the Academy Award-winning movie, I mean, there was always this kind of running theme throughout them of anger and these, you know, sort of repressed common man heroes who finally get a chance to kind of pop off, and then they do so in very explosive and verbal ways, and that's one of the ideas that carries all the way through into Network.
And one of the things that's fascinating as you detail in the book is his really frustration with the medium of television, a medium that he had worked in and found some success, but became increasingly frustrated by working in it and also being a part of that culture.
Absolutely. If you go all the way back to, you know, what's considered the golden age of TV when he got his start in the 1950s, and you look at his own writing on his work at that time, you already see this kind of brimming frustration, the fact that he feels that he doesn't really have control over how the work that he writes gets produced, and, you know, he's never consulted on casting, he doesn't get to be present when things are filmed, and so that really, that sort of directs his career going forward, that he's increasingly looking for control over his own work and only seeking out situations where he can essentially be in charge. That level of control is very hard to come by, and just even seeking that, he's sort of setting himself up for a certain amount of disappointment. And then, you know, as he kind of stumbles through or moves through, I should say, you know, a career in live theater and Broadway, and then, you know, earlier efforts in motion pictures, you know, he's very frustrated when, you know, things don't come across quite the way that he hoped. And even with his works that are successful, he has this kind of lingering feeling that audiences aren't grasping the many messages that he's trying to sort of send them in his writing.
And the thing that is so fascinating is how highly personal the project was, and ultimately how involved he wanted to be, how much control he wanted, to the point where when a scene was going on, he wanted to be just steps away from where those lines were being delivered because he wanted to make sure that every word that he wrote was coming out of that actor's mouth the way that he wrote it.
Exactly, and that they had to structure a very sort of unusual arrangement for him where, as you were saying, he literally, as the film is being shot, I mean, is not only sitting on set, but, you know, feet away from the actors. They had to create a special light for him to sit under, just sort of off to the side, away from the camera, so that he could be sort of point blank to the actors or that, you know, close enough to them, but not end up in the shot. And it speaks not only to his demand for control, but also the kind of collaboration that he had with the director, Sidney Lumet, who was very much an actor's director and also had plenty of years of his own experience in television, but sufficiently accommodating that he would accept this arrangement, which probably many other directors would not have stood for.
When it comes to the message of the film and that prophetic nature, What do you make of that? Because it's fascinating to see how the film was originally received and how the view has changed over the past 35, almost 40 years.
Yeah, that one was one of the most remarkable experiences for me in writing the book, was just poring over those reviews from its time of release in 1976. Certainly, it was a very polarizing movie. There were, plenty of negative reviews, but even among the positive reviews, even the supporters of the film had this belief, that they would just very easily verbalize this idea that this is just a satire. It's this sort of preposterous, over-the-top vision of a world that could never exist. And now, when you look at how it treats television and how television gets made, it's just standard operating procedure. It's hardly even satire in that sense. And so, it certainly speaks to how exactly right he got it. Although, I don't know. If you asked him probably on a day-to-day basis at different times a day, sometimes Chayefsky would tell you, yes, this is very much a movie about TV and what's going wrong with it. And at other times, he would probably tell you it was something that was meant to be much more ambitious. It wasn't commenting solely on TV or specifically on TV, but on just man's alienation from himself and how even the society that he lived in 76, how rapidly it was moving and how, disconnected people could be from each other. And this is in a pre-internet era. This isn't even in an era of the 24-hour news cycle. All people have are, televisions and telephones and typewriters.
You write in the book about how Chayefsky was really baffled by much of the criticism, especially from the criticism that came from the industry. When you have somebody like Walter Cronkite, whose face is at the very beginning of the film, calling it a fantasy burlesque and saying that he didn't find any great significance in it. And Chayefsky seemed confused by that and saying that he felt that some people may have looked at it as a payback to television, and he didn't really have any animosity toward television.
Right, right. Well, I think that it's very true that he did not anticipate the sort of the strong negative reaction that was going to come, from the TV news business. And certainly I think that goes back to it, just even when he was conducting the research, for the film, that he was given access to, NBC News, CBS News, they let him come and poke around and observe. And at the time, he didn't quite know what kind of a film he was going to write. It certainly, evolved into a darker satire after he paid those visits. And he never really thought to tell anybody, hey, by the way, this is what the film is going to be, and don't be surprised and don't be offended. But again, because he thought it had this sort of larger message, that it wasn't solely a commentary on, the TV business, he never stopped to really think about, well, how might the people in that world react to the movie? He just assumed they were going to grasp what he was aiming for, and that they wouldn't mind being portrayed in such a light. But then, of course, he does end up writing letters of apology to Cronkite and to John Chancellor, basically saying, you know, I'm sorry if you felt hurt or felt used. And those, if you know anything about Chayefsky, he was a man who rarely apologized for anything. So those were, I'm sure, very difficult letters for him to write.
Talk a little bit about the performances in this film, because I think that is really, it's one thing that there's words on those page on the page, but the performances are so extraordinary, evidenced by the great number of Academy Award nominations and even awards that it received, from the smallest role of Ned Beatty to the largest role of course with Peter Finch and William Holden.
Sure. I think it's a credit to all of the actors, certainly, that they were able to master this kind of very challenging dialogue. I mean, written almost more like a stage play, in a sense that you have these kind of long monologues as opposed to, you know, the sort of shorter, briefer exchanges of dialogue. But among, let's say, the three principal actors of, you know, Faye Dunaway, Peter Finch, and William Holden, right. I mean, you have people whose careers are going in very different directions. Dunaway certainly is in ascent at this time and has already done Bonnie and Clyde and Chinatown and received Oscar nominations for them. Throughout the casting process, she's always at the top of their list and is the very first person that they cast in the movie. With Holden and with Finch, Holden certainly had a tremendous career arc by then, but, you know, the perception of him at the time is that he's kind of winding things down. And likewise with Finch, who was not really on anybody's radar. He did have an Oscar nomination for Sunday Bloody Sunday, but by that point in his career, he's, you know, living in Jamaica in a kind of semi-retirement, and the producers of the film only come to him because they've essentially exhausted every other option to play Howard Beale. They've been turned down by Paul Newman and George C. Scott. They're thinking of people like Jimmy Stewart and Walter Matthau, and those things just don't even come to fruition. So Finch is something of a last resort, but proves to be the exact right person for the role.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it.
And that story is a sad story because he passes away just after the film is being released, and he's being nominated for an Oscar that he ultimately wins posthumously.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the many sort of eerie, you know, kind of ironic overtones of the network story, that here he is, you know, the film goes into wide release, you know, in the fall of 1976, and he's getting these tremendous reviews for it, but also, you know, doing a lot of the promotion for the movie to keep it out there in the public eye in the hopes that it gets nominated for awards, that sort of thing. And then he dies in January of 1977 and, you know, later is nominated for and wins the Oscar. He's the first actor ever to win an Academy Award posthumously. And it creates a sort of awkward situation for the Academy because they've never had to deal with that situation before. I think they are uncomfortable about the idea that here you have a white actor who had a black wife, and the idea of his widow accepting that trophy for him, and at least in 1977, is something that makes some people uncomfortable. And Chayefsky and his colleagues have to sort of devise this kind of subterfuge to make sure that she can get up on stage and receive the trophy for him.
You quote Stephen Colbert in the book of saying that what Network correctly anticipated is news is entertainment, and that he got it dead on, as you talked about earlier, and you have to wonder of how much did he plant the seed.
Well, you know, I think that that's one of the conflicts that you see throughout the movie, that, you know, basically the conflict that is occurring between the professional conflict, at least between the William Holden and Faye Dunaway characters, and the Holden as the sort of old school newsman and Dunaway as the latter day or present day entertainment executive. And of course, she's always warning Holden, you know, I'm going to take over your news show. I'm going to turn it into an entertainment program. And And that, I mean, that is literally what happens to television news. I mean, a few years after Chayefsky dies, but that essentially the networks stop looking at their news divisions as these kind of, these they won't let them be loss leaders anymore, and they're not allowed these sort of, unimpeachable positions where they can just, you know, report the news without having to turn a profit in some way for, their corporations. And so that's, they do essentially become subsumed by their entertainment divisions. That's exactly what transpires.
So for us as a viewing public, how can we look at this film and say, okay, even at the time in 1976, and say, okay, this is entertainment, this is something that I'm going to enjoy and have it be in our conscious. And then, of course, as it becomes a cult classic, we all know it, we revisit it from time to time, and yet we allow exactly what it illustrates to happen.
Well, in some ways, what it was predicting, since it's already occurred, I mean, we don't watch it in the same way as an audience in 1976
right.
would have. And that's, I mean, that's part of, in some ways, if you want to call it the joy of the film. I mean, there's, in a way, there's nothing we can do anymore. We can't, at least in terms of what happened to the media, we can't prevent that from occurring anymore. And that warning didn't get heeded, and here we are. But there is, there is a larger message that the film is trying to communicate, just about alienation and corruption and the sort of omnipresent risks that they pose. And that's still very true, and it makes no difference sort of what media environment we're living in. If anything, we live in a world now that's populated by, thousands of Howard Beals, whether they're on television or on the internet. And it's very much up to us as a viewing and listening audience to decide, well, who, if any of these figures, do we want to receive our information from? And, how do we want to conduct ourselves as people in a world like this? And, those kinds of messages that are, those are the messages that the film is putting forth that are still, I think, extremely relevant to today, and it can still, be learned from.
There are so many wonderful scenes in the film. I think that's when we all, of course, know the...
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Sure.
But there are so many great scenes in the film, and even scenes that you forget after a couple of years, perhaps. But I just viewed the film again, and it's amazing of how, yes, when you talked about joy, but there are some wonderful moments of great comedy in the film.
Yes. I think I'm sure everybody has their favorites, but, even the one long speech that's given by Ned Beatty late in the movie, where
right.
he's playing the chairman of the corporation that has bought up the television network. And, if you just look at the language of his speech, which is all about how, there are no nations and there's just, there is just commerce and there's just dollars being traded among corporations and that's the flow of the world, that language is very cynical and very frightening. But his delivery of and performance of that speech is so sort of wonderfully comic and so exuberant. And there's this wonderful sort of contrast between the language and how he portrays it. And he gets so sort of worked up into that performance. And it's not a particularly realistic scene, but it's just so delightful to watch.
Aaron Sorkin, who has obviously so been influenced by Paddy Chayefsky and by the movie Network, and takes his own stab at Network News in the newsroom, says that you wish Chayefsky would come back to live long enough to write The Internet.
I love that line of his. I happen to think that, in some ways Sorkin did that himself with a movie that was called The Social Network.
Sure.
And I have to believe that that title, in a certain way was nodding back to Network.
And he credited Chayefsky in his acceptance speech.
Right, that's right. When he won the Oscar
yeah.
for that screenplay, of course, he had to mention, the connection or the debt that he felt that he owed. Certainly, I think there's a little more maybe humanism or optimism in Sorkin's work. I think he probably believes that there is redemption for us all, or that we're capable of better things. I don't know if Chayefsky felt that. I think he was a lot more pessimistic about our trajectory, although that's what led him to these very accurate predictions. By betting against us, he won.
Well, the book is endlessly fascinating and enjoyable. It's Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. It is published by Times Books. David Itzkoff, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book is Mad as Hell by Dave Itzkoff. It is published by Times Books.
This was the story of Howard Beale, the first known instance of a man who was killed because he had lousy ratings.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.